Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I think we should always ask ourselves what we don't know in Australia, because we don't have robust protections for whistleblowers and for press freedom.
I'm in the space where I have to accept that there are serious national security threats that our country is facing, and we do have an obligation, and the government has an obligation, to make sure that our agencies are equipped with the appropriate powers to deal with those threats.
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National Security College.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Danielle Ireland-Piper, Associate Professor and Academic Director at the ANU National Security College. Today's podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and to that end, I acknowledge the traditional custodians and offer my respects to elders past and present. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by Kieran Panda and Dr. Dominic Dalla Pozza to talk about national security oversight. Welcome both.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
So Kieran Panda is a senior lawyer in the Democratic Freedoms Team at the Human Rights Law Centre, where he works on a range of issues relating to human rights and national security. He's also an honorary lecturer at the ANU College of Law. Dr. Dominic Dalla Pozza is a senior lecturer with the ANU College of Law and has recently come on board to help us teach our national security law subject as well. Dominic's research interests are primarily focused on public law and national security oversight. So we're here today to talk about accountability in national security and why that's important. Of course, there are many different types of accountability, from whistleblowers, parliamentary committees, courts, and the press. Who watches the watchers, if you will? National security is about protecting our existence and our values. There's obviously a need for secrecy on one hand, but not to the extent where we undermine the very thing we are trying to protect. Transparency and accountability in itself can protect national security. So that said, I've got a question for both Kieran and Dom. Can I ask you both to briefly introduce yourselves and your backgrounds, and how did you become interested in the issue of oversight and accountability in the national security context?
Well, thanks, Danielle. So I became interested in national security law when I was doing my PhD research at UNSW. So I was at UNSW to do a project on the way in which the laws immediately post 9/11, the September 11 attacks in the US, were passed by the Australian Parliament. And so that's what I spent time doing in the early 2000s. From there, that sparked my interest in what Parliament was doing, and from there I got interested in parliamentary committees, and it's a very short skip and a jump from parliamentary committees to oversight more generally. And so that's how I got interested in what I'm interested in.
Wonderful. And we'll come back to the issue of parliamentary committees soon. They play a really important role in the national security context, probably an underestimated one. And what about yourself, Kieran? How did you get interested in these issues?
Mainly by accident. I think
all good things.
such an interesting paradox in this area, which is that, you know, secrecy is antithetical to a democracy. The idea of sort of government of the people by the people, that people need to know, and yet we accept that in the sake of national security, we sacrifice some of that transparency and we accept some secrecy in the interests of protecting all of us. But that tension, because it cuts across so many of these key democratic principles, I think is so important. And so my background is in whistleblowing, and then that sort of led to more interest in secrecy and transparency and intelligence oversight. And we've seen, you know, we might come on to in that space, you know, recently in the last few years, I've been involved in a number of reviews by the Independent National Security Legislation Monitor, which is a really important oversight body. And that sort of, again, I went down the rabbit hole in participating in that.
But it's such an important rabbit hole. On the topic of whistleblowers, whistleblowers really sit at that intersection, don't they, of the tension between secrecy and duty on one hand and the need for transparency and accountability and the public interest in exposing potential official wrongdoing. Can you explain to us who is a whistleblower and what is the state of whistleblowing protection in Australia right now? Can we improve?
Yes, we can improve. Whistleblowers make Australia a better place. They make the world a better place. And because of that lack of transparency in the national security context, they're particularly important mechanism for accountability and transparency in that context. Yeah, if we think of some of the major international revelations of, you know, going back decades, the Pentagon Papers, a national security whistleblower, more recently Edward Snowden, revelations of mass surveillance by US security institutions. There's a very good movie out recently that I'd encourage everyone to watch. So it's about an American national security whistleblower in relation to sort of Russia and Trump and so on. But again, we have this tension of, well, at what point is it okay for someone to speak up? And in Australia, our laws and systems aren't properly calibrated. Whistleblowing takes place at different levels. So, you know, the basic level is you'd expect people to speak up when they see something wrong at work. Any of us, you know, might see something wrong at work tomorrow. The things that I see wrong at my work, I work from home, so are not so significant as those, you know, if you work in the intelligence sector, if you work in the national security sector, what you might see at work might be more important. And, you know, we'd normally assume that you'd speak up to your boss, to a director, to an oversight body, and go through those stages. But I think the sort of the whistleblowing and the concept that sort of often sort of associated in the press or in the public imagination is what happens when that doesn't work, either because you speak up and things go wrong and you're not heard and maybe you suffer retaliation at work. And we know, you know, not only in the national security context but across the economy, far too many people who speak up about wrongdoing at work suffer consequences. They lose their job, they're bullied, they're demoted and so on. And then what happens when...
Or prosecuted,
as we might talk about. But what happens when things go really wrong and what happens when the issue isn't dealt with and you need to go public? And one of the, you know, and that's a challenge, that balancing that desire for governance and regulatory framework with transparency and when a whistleblower can go public to achieve change and to achieve accountability is a fraught issue in any context, but it's particularly fraught in the national security context. And in Australia right now, if you work in the intelligence sector, you can't go public in any circumstance. And that's a problem.
Right. So correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand that there is some federal legislation that protects public interest disclosures, but there are carve-outs that don't allow people who work in national security agencies to do so. Again, correct me if I'm wrong, the new Anti-Corruption Commission does create new avenues for people who work in national security to disclose. Is that correct? Is that helping with the balance or is there still more to do?
I think there's still more to do. At the moment, a national security whistleblower can speak up internally. They can speak up to the Inspector General for Intelligence and Security. They can't go beyond that. So an ordinary public servant or someone working in the private sector in an emergency situation or where they've tried to speak up internally and issues haven't been resolved, there are avenues for them to safely and lawfully blow the whistle to MPs and senators or to the press or indeed in the case of the public sector to the world at large. In whistleblowing matters that concern intelligence information, that pathway does not exist. Okay, you might say, well, that's a reasonable compromise, but the problem is intelligence information is defined so broadly that it actually represents a significant deficiency in our oversight and accountability mechanism. So the number of staplers at ASIO would be intelligence information that if there was a procurement fraud at ASIO, if the person buying staplers at ASIO was acting corruptly in procuring the staplers from his or her mate, then you couldn't take that public. Now, you know, obviously that's a ridiculous example, but I think what we haven't really
quite nailed at the moment is that calibration. Of course, no one thinks that intelligence officers should be able to go public at the drop of a hat. But in my view, there are certain circumstances where when internal mechanisms don't work, there needs to be an external check and balance. And at the moment, in the national security context, we don't have that. And so we see, for example, the prosecution of Witness K and Bernard Collieri. Witness K, an intelligence officer who was alleged and ultimately sentenced and convicted in relation to blowing the whistle on Australia's espionage against Timor-Leste in the mid-2000s, and his lawyer, Bernard Collieri. A case where I think many people would say Australia spying on another country, a neighbour, a friendly neighbour for commercial gain.
There's a public interest.
Really significant questions about the lawfulness and the sort of ethicalness of that conduct. The reason that Witness K was ultimately convicted and pleaded guilty was because there was no lawful avenue for that person to speak up. And again, how you calibrate those settings, you know, there's some complexity there. I don't deny that. I'm not for an instant saying that spies should be able to get on Twitter and say, oh, bad stuff happening at ASIO. But in Australia, and, you know, we compare to some other jurisdictions where they have slightly more sophisticated checks and balances. And to come back to that point earlier about the paradox, the reason I think this is so important is because of the importance of trust that sits at the heart of all of this. We sacrifice the transparency because we trust our intelligence services, the national security framework, to make us safe. If we lose that trust because they act in the wrong way and then they cover it up, as in the Witness K case, as in some other cases, we lose that trust, we're all worse off as a result. And so Peter Grester, the journalist, often says national security and transparency are not a binary. They're not in opposition. Actually, they're mutually reinforcing because we are safer when we have transparency and accountability, and we trust that when we do have secrecy, it's being properly used. And whistleblowers are a really important part of that ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, public trust is really important to institutional effectiveness and efficiency. So that's a really important point. Before we move on to bring Dom in, I wondered if you think, Kieran, the solution lies in, taking your point that it's very complicated, but does the solution lie in having a narrower definition of what national security is or what special intelligence operations are, or isn't it having a legal exception where a matter can be seen to be in the public interest? And would we have courts overseeing what that is?
Yeah, so I think there's a range of changes that are needed. One, we definitely need to narrow the definitions. Currently, they're too broad, and that's having this exclusionary effect. To give another absurd, not that absurd example, but, you know, for example, if an ASIO
Securitization of stationery is an issue, Kieran.
Definitely. But if an ASIO officer tomorrow commits murder, cold blood, absolutely no relation to an operation. Say they speak up internally, nothing's done. Say they speak up to the Inspector General, nothing's done. That's the end of the road. And how can that be right? And of course, we would all think that it would be dealt with appropriately. But the reason we have these checks and balances in other contexts is we know that sometimes things go wrong. The Witness J, not to confuse people with too many witnesses, but Witness J case is another example where an ASIO intelligence officer was prosecuted and convicted and sentenced in total secrecy. And the National Security Legislation Monitor did a report and said that should never have happened and it could never happen again. And again, the problem when we have these examples, it undermines trust because it's all well and good for people to say, well, you'd never have a secret trial. That's absurd. That's not we wouldn't do that in Australia. And then we have one. Mm-hmm. So I think we need that reform. We need some of those pathways. We, Human Rights Law Centre and others, have called for a general fallback public interest defence. So in a case like Witness K, for the law to say, look, even if this was otherwise unlawful, for someone to say it was in the public interest and a judge to be able to determine that. The government, in a recent review of secrecy offences, declined to support that idea, which we're disappointed by and will continue to push for. We've got to get those checks and balances right to get that balance.
Thanks, Kieran. And speaking of judges and courts, Dom, of course, a lot of your research looks into the way different parts of our legal system offer accountability and important checks and balances. And of course, we're lucky to live in a country where we do have an independent judicial system. And of course, that's enshrined in our constitution. And so I'm really interested to talk to you about some of the roles that the court plays,
But before we get there, of course, Parliament itself has a lot of other, I guess you could almost call them soft mechanisms, including parliamentary committees. Would you like to speak to the role that parliamentary committees play in this?
Sure. And I would say first that we can't forget the courts, and that we'll talk about later how the courts can get involved in national security issues. It doesn't happen often, but when it does happen, it can sometimes be quite can change quite a bit. But because of the difficulties of getting judicial oversight in national security and intelligence matters, what we've done in Australia is develop a range of other bodies that try and provide some of the accountability and oversight that is really important, as Kieran said, particularly in this area of activity where the state is able to do some really intrusive things. So we've got things like the Ombudsman and the National Anti-Corruption Commission, which you referred to earlier. But the really big three forms of oversight mechanisms that we typically talk about when we're talking about Australian national security are the Inspector General of Intelligence and Security that Kieran has already mentioned. And that's the independent executive body that provides what we call operational oversight of the activities of the main national security agencies. We also have the Independent National Security Legislation Monitor, which Kieran has also discussed. And that's a body that's the most recent of the three big oversight entities. And it's an independent office that really reviews legislative frameworks once they've been passed and operating for a while to give a sort of overview of how the legislation is working. And then we get to the parliament, the role played by parliamentary committees. And as you've said, parliamentary committees over a long period of time have played some really interesting roles in the development of Australia's national security legislative framework. But the big committee that has had the most to do with the development of that framework in recent times is the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security. And it's been in operation in one form or another for about 30 years. But it's really only taken its central role as sort of the linchpin of the committee which sees most of the national security legislation that goes through the parliament and reviews it before it's enacted. It's really had that role specifically for about the last 8 to 10 years. And so I think the committee's work is really important because they're at that stage, they're the only body that can look at a legislative framework before it's been passed. And they are able to suggest changes. And there's a fair bit of research that says they've been pretty successful. If a change is recommended by the Parliamentary Joint Committee, at least in recent times, most of them have a good chance of being enacted into law. So it's a very influential and powerful committee in that sense.
So in a way, to put it simply, the role that that committee plays is in making our laws better.
Well, that's in theory, and at its best, that is what we'd like to think that it could be. The way that I look at it is, it's better to have a committee than not have a committee. I'd much rather a committee look at these bills before they're enacted, or sometimes after they're enacted, and see what changes can be made to improve them. And I think it's also important that the committee plays a role after the fact, in conjunction with the independent monitor, to see how the laws can be improved. Because the key thing about the committee is that it's staffed, it's composed of parliamentarians, staffed obviously by our members of the public service. And so they are the ones, they're our legislators. They're doing the job that we've sent them there to do by looking at proposed laws and trying to make them the best that they can be.
So on that, being composed by parliamentarians, sometimes it's a criticism in the national security space that there's almost too much bipartisan cooperation and not enough contestation of potentially controversial laws. Do you think that plays out in the committee, or could you give an example of where the committee's played an important role in making a change to a law?
I think that, one of the things that the committee has done, not so recently, but they did recommend that powers that were given to ASIO to question and detain people who were suspected of having information relevant to a terrorism offence, the detention powers had never actually been used. And it was a combined effort, really, of the INSLM and the Parliamentary Joint Committee, but they did manage to get the detention power repealed. It was replaced by a compulsory questioning power warrant, which, again, like Kieran, I'm in the space where I have to accept that there are serious national security threats that our country is facing, and we do have an obligation, and the government has an
an obligation to make sure that our agencies are equipped with the appropriate powers to deal with those threats. But interestingly, the Parliamentary Joint Committee was essential in getting the detention powers, which had never been used, repealed. And so that is a good example of how over time, if you have sustained oversight of your legislative frameworks, you can make a judgment from time to time and go, well, we thought we might have needed this in 2003 when we were still in the immediate aftermath of the shock of 9/11. Fast forward many years, and we've decided actually this isn't the best legal solution to the problems and the intelligence problems that we face. And so I'm really heartened by the work the parliamentary committees can do in those spaces.
Right. Yeah, law's not going to be fit for purpose forever.
No.
Right. So the law gets enacted, the parliamentary committee has some oversight, it then goes into operation. Where does the High Court come in, Dom? And are there, we've seen, you know, recently the High Court makes some really interesting decisions on indefinite detention and citizenship stripping. What role does the court play in oversight of national security?
So obviously the High Court, as you've mentioned in your introduction, and our independent judiciary system overall is protected by our constitution, which means that ultimately, as long as you can get a case before them, they get to decide whether the laws that are passed by Parliament are constitutional or not. And that basically, that they're in charge of laying down the rules that set the parameters of the playing field, to completely mix my metaphors, that will allow Parliament to enact legislation that's constitutional, that's good for all of us. And so in relation to citizenship cessation specifically, in 2022 and in 2023, there were two cases decided by the High Court where the High Court actually invalidated part of the national security framework that allowed the Minister for Home Affairs to decide that a dual citizen had repudiated their allegiance to Australia by engaging in terrorist conduct, and so they should lose their Australian citizenship. The outcome of the two cases was that the High Court said, no, in those circumstances, that losing your citizenship is a form of punishment. And our constitution says that only a court in our system can levy punishment. So the rules changed. The playing space for Parliament, the space in which they can make legislation, was redefined, or defined in a way that we hadn't previously understood, by the High Court. As a result, it's now Parliament's job to make legislation within those redrawn boundaries. And that is what Parliament did in relation to citizenship cessation just at the end of last week. We have had new laws that have just passed the Parliament to redefine who can strip a person of their citizenship if they have been deemed to have engaged in terrorist conduct. Interestingly, the Parliamentary Joint Committee in this instance is currently reviewing that act. So one of the compromises to get the act passed through Parliament very, very quickly was that it would be referred to the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security for review, and that review is open for submissions now. So if anyone listening would like to make a submission, that's another great virtue of the committee. They take submissions from the public, and they are genuinely interested in what people have to say about the laws that affect us all.
We'll be right back.
In this disrupted world, Australia needs security professionals more than ever. Join the next generation studying at the ANU National Security College. Our programs uniquely fuse academic knowledge with practitioner experience and fit around your lifestyle with study offered online and on campus. Follow the link in the show notes for more information about programs and scholarships. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
Yeah, that's a really important point about citizenship participation in lawmaking, is that we are able to make submissions, and they can be a really helpful and effective way of engaging with lawmaking. And of course, Dom, listening to you, it occurs to me how important court oversight is of things like punishment when we live in a system where we don't have a constitutional charter or a bill of rights that protects things like fair trial rights or due process. The courts are sort of all that stands between an individual and the power of the state in some ways. So that's a really important point. Another really important aspect of our national security systems and oversight, of course, which is a bit more informal and in some ways a little bit more controversial, of course, is the free press. And so, Kieran, this is a different type of oversight, and in some ways it's the touchstone between the people and government. So why do we need a free press, and why does this issue come up in the context of national security?
Just to segue nicely from Dominic's comments, I want to begin by reference to my favourite High Court case.
Oh, we've all got one.
which involved ASIO seeking an injunction to prevent a journalist identifying an intelligence officer. And ASIO did something they shouldn't have done, which was they had officers go into the court building in the High Court in Canberra and ask people who are in the public gallery. Obviously, courts are typically held in open court. You can go in and anyone can watch. And you had ASIO officers asking people for their names and addresses. And Justice Dean of the High Court, this was in the 1980s, found out about this and hauled the government into the court and said, "What on earth were you doing?" and gave them a telling off. And it's sort of this really important statement of the importance of open justice and the integrity of the court system separate from our intelligence structures. And that attempt to interfere in the court's processes was looked upon very dimly. I'm not actually sure whether the journalist ultimately published the identity of the ASIO officer, but that's my favourite High Court case. so press freedom obviously is at the heart of any democracy linked into these notions of transparency and accountability. But as you say, it's a largely informal role. So many of those stories that I spoke about at the beginning have been broken by important public interest journalism. You know, we've seen so many examples in recent months, you know, the Ben Robert Smith reporting, which was vindicated by a federal court judgment, although I know that's on appeal at the moment, you know, perhaps a good example of the sort of accountability journalism when other checks and balances had failed.
For those who might not be familiar, could you just briefly explain the background of that case?
Sure. Allegations of war crimes committed by Australian forces in Afghanistan, and there's been a series of reporting, the ABC's Afghan Files reporting, which was sourced by a whistleblower, and the Ben Robert Smith related reporting by Channel 9, by Nick McKenzie and Chris Masters and others. You know, indications of the sort of accountability journalism clearly in the public interest that ensures Australians can say, you know, that conduct is abhorrent, cannot be done in our name, and has led to some of the accountability and change we've seen in that space. In Australia, as you mentioned, we don't have robust constitutional or human rights protections for press freedom and free speech. We have a frail implied freedom. The High Court has said the Constitution has sort of from the vibe of it some protection for free speech. That's very limited. We have Human Rights Acts in the ACT, Queensland and Victoria. We don't have a federal human rights charter, although that's something that is being discussed at the moment.
And we saw Queensland recently suspend their own Human Rights Act, in any event.
Indeed. And what all that means is, although we don't have this robust protection for free speech and press freedom, the press nonetheless plays this important role. And we saw that, for example, some of the journalism that led to the raids on the ABC, which was in relation to the Afghan Files reporting, the raids on Annika Smethurst was in relation to intelligence. It was she had reported for News Corp proposals to expand powers for the intelligence service, and her house was raided. And she went to the High Court to link all this back together, and the High Court said that the warrant to raid her house was invalid. And I think those cases demonstrated the precariousness of the role of press, the press as a safeguard. It's led to a number of reviews and inquiries, which including from the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security, some of the changes are working their way through now. But I think it's a good example of the importance of more robust institutional protections, because without those, the role that we all take for granted, that the press is there to hold government to account as the Fourth Estate, is often quite a precarious role. And we saw recently more reporting by Nick McKenzie and others in the Nine newspapers about proposals that the former Home Affairs Secretary Mike Bazzullo had to create a scheme similar to in the United Kingdom, where intelligence national security agencies could seek to prevent the media from publishing stories, what's been described as a denotice style scheme. And that led to, you know, some concern, and ultimately Mr. Bozzullo has lost his role in light of the politicisation of Home Affairs and some concern that arose in that reporting. But I think another example of we should be really wary whenever there are these attempts to, you know, already we don't have enough protection for press freedom in Australia, given the important role it plays in our democracy. We should always be wary of further encroachment.
If you'll indulge me in a devil's advocate moment, how do we ensure, though, that journalists themselves are responsible in reporting on national security related issues and aren't undermining efforts by national security agencies to keep us safe?
That's a great question. I think we have to, you know, accept this natural tension, and that sometimes the role of the press is the price we pay for a free society. I think that leaves it incumbent on the media to report in a sensible, fair and accurate way. I know that the ANU outgoing Vice Chancellor Brian Schmidt gave an address to the Press Club recently that talked about the importance of the media stepping up. But I don't think the answer to national security is ever, in that context, to further undermine the role of the press, because that's a role that is the sort of the price we pay. You know, I'm often reminded when I appeared before one of these recent inquiries, someone from one of the intelligence services was bemoaning the administrative burden imposed by one of these pieces of legislation. And I thought to myself, well, you know, that's the price. Administrative burden is the price of democracy, and press freedom and the role the press play. You know, and I think you can think of recent examples, less so in Australia, but in the UK, for example, with the WikiLeaks reporting that The Guardian led on, Edward Snowden, and so on. And there were real attempts by the US and UK intelligence services to prevent that reporting, and some of that's been recounted at length. I don't think we can say that the world is not a better place. The world is a better place because we know what was being done in our name, the level of mass surveillance, and there's been sort of safeguards and checks and balances brought in the US, in the UK and elsewhere to try and recalibrate that because of that reporting. We might not know that if the intelligence services in the UK had been allowed to prevent that reporting. I think we should always ask ourselves what we don't know in Australia, because we don't have robust protections for whistleblowers and for press freedom.
Right. And of course, ultimately, national security is about protecting the public, and the public has a right and a stake in what's being done in its name. So there's obviously some very important issues of public interest that play out in the national security context, not least because of the broadening definition and understanding of what national security is beyond the traditional sort of bombs and guns space to more non-traditional aspects of national security, such as climate. We've seen, of course, recent examples of the use of terrorism laws against eco-activists and so on. So these are issues of genuine public interest and public debate. I guess we've all sort of conceded and accepted that national security agencies and national security work requires a long leash, but have all acknowledged that complex balance in ensuring that it doesn't defeat what it is we're trying to protect. I wonder if either of you, starting with you, Dom, have any additional examples or comments you'd like to make about that balance?
Well, it's perennial, like there, and it is not static. So as we were talking about in my earlier example, one of the key things about making sure that we manage that tension as well between national security and rights and freedoms is to continually revisit the way in which we have drawn the balances from time to time in legislation. And so an example that's currently I'm thinking about, prompted by the work of a former colleague of ours, Associate Professor Jake Blight, who is now has taken on the role of the Independent National Security Legislation Monitor, but published this work before he took on the role. He was thinking about historically how ASIO was empowered to access our telecommunications data and what's sometimes referred to as metadata. And in an article that he recently published in the Alternative Law Review, Law Journal, I beg your pardon, he mentioned that the test that ASIO uses to be able to obtain that telecommunications data from communications carriers hasn't changed since 1991.
And he makes the point that in 1991, we were 20 years away from the iPhone, and the amount of data that you could and information could glean about a person from their metadata was very limited. Fast forward to now, and you can tell an awful lot about a person from the activity that they do using their phones and using email and other forms of electronic communication without necessarily having to get the content of that legislation. So Associate Professor Blight was writing in the wake of the Richardson Review, and that was a review done into Australia's national security intelligence legislative frameworks. And one of the key recommendations from that review was that Australia's laws in relation to electronic surveillance really needed a major overhaul. And to the best of my knowledge, that overhaul is being undertaken by the Attorney General's Department, and it's ongoing. But it's a real area where we need to be very alive to how we're going to balance issues of privacy and proportionality that Associate Professor Blight was particularly interested in his article, against the need to ensure that our agencies are able to collect the information they need to gather intelligence and keep us safe. So that balancing process in that particular space, electronic surveillance, is one that I'm looking at pretty closely and following as best I can into the future.
That's great. Thanks, Dom. And I think your point about surveillance really illustrates the fact that, you know, they say love is a verb. Mm. National security law is also a verb. It's live, it's active, and it won't always be fit for purpose. So we need to keep an eye on it. And technological surveillance is a really good example of that. Kieran, any parting comments?
It's a really important time in this space. We're seeing a lot of reform. The government's moving forward at a really frenetic pace in a range of areas. Surveillance, as Dominic mentioned, is an important one that's ongoing. Secrecy law reform ongoing. The National Security Monitor just handed down a report recently in relation to national security law as it applies to courts. That reform, we're seeing whistleblowing reform next year. So there's a lot happening, and I agree with what's been said. It's a constant attempt to get the right, correct calibration. I always think in terms of, you know, necessity. Are these truly powers, truly necessary, proportionate? And then what are the safeguards? What are the oversight mechanisms? Because I think there's always a real concern that national security agencies take these powers and then they're used in very different contexts. So, you know, I participated in an inquiry in relation to the Identify and Disrupt bill, which expands the surveillance powers of our national security and law enforcement agencies. The framework there had initially in the bill was set at 3 years, you know, in relation to you could use these incredible, really unprecedented surveillance powers in relation to potential serious offences, and that was set at 3 years. And so I had one of my lawyers go through and, like, look at all of the offences that are caught by 3 years. And there were, you know, I pulled out all of these offences, like, you know, capturing a dolphin, you can be in prison for 3 years. All of these to make the point. And ultimately, the committee did recommend some changes to the bill, which then became law, which we welcomed those improvements. But we've got to be really careful, because otherwise you see, and in the metadata context, we've seen local councils getting metadata. We've seen the RSPCA getting metadata. It's not, unfortunately, in this space too often, these powers are driven by concerns about, you know, terrorism, child sex abuse, serious drug trafficking. But we've always got to be wary that often these powers are used in more mundane contexts. And the Australian criminal justice system, over centuries inherited from the English, has sought to calibrate our liberties and our freedoms with public interest in sort of security and protection. And when we start meddling with that, we do so at our own risk and in a context where we don't have a human rights framework embedded at a federal level that would better ensure those principles of proportionality and necessity were baked in from the very beginning. So it's an exciting time, a lot of areas for reform. It's an area where we have to be constantly vigilant, and that vigilance is the price we pay to live in a democracy.
Yeah, and with great power, of course, comes great responsibility. Thank you both for your input today. Many of these issues go to the core of who we are as a society, who we are as a people, who we are as a legal system, and so much of what our national security community is trying to protect. Thanks very much for your time, and I look forward to having you again on the podcast.
Thanks, Daniel.
Pleasure.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.